And this is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with
Ken Nash.
Which side are you on? The story of Bisbee, Arizona's ethnic cleansing of 1,300 immigrant mine workers. The lessons of then for now.
And to set the pace, we have The Bisbee Deportation of 1917, a short documentary by high school students.
They have herded us like cattle, torn us from our homes and wives. Yes, we've heard their rifles rattle and have feared for our lives. It was in the morning early of that fatal July 12th, and the year 1917, this took place in which I tell.
On July 12, 1917, Arizona's Cochise County Sheriff Harry Wheeler, nearly 2,000 men deported striking copper miners in Bisbee to Columbus, New Mexico against their will. The Bisbee deportation was a turning point economically, politically, and socially for the town of Bisbee, the state of Arizona, the country, and the world. In 1877, men marching through Tombstone Canyon in southeastern Arizona discovered copper. After Phelps Dodge, a dominant copper company, acquired social power, pro-management Republican Thomas Campbell was able to become the second governor of Arizona over Hunt in the election of 1916, foretelling a major misfortune for the unions.
And as individual, one small cog in a large corporation, they quickly realized that if they were losing their identity with a craft, with a skill, and they were losing their ability to negotiate.
In April 1917, the United States broke its neutrality with Europe and entered World War I. Prices of copper and working hours soared, while the rate of pay for the miners went up only a trifle. Meanwhile, the industrial workers of the world, also known as the IWW, finally succeeded in establishing their union in Bisbee. Upset at capitalistic companies such as Phelps Dodge, the IWW and supporting miners gave the mining companies a list of grievances and demands for better working conditions. Management furiously refused the demands. The IWW called a peaceful strike on June 27th for all workers until management met their stipulations. Anti-union propaganda was used all over the state against the IWW. Walter Douglas, president of Phelps Dodge, said, "An infected sore may well become a cancer if it is not cut out."
As World War I progressed, Bisbee, like the rest of the country, got caught up not only in the fervor of the war, but they also became convinced, because of their proximity to the Mexican border and the civil conflict, much of it in northern Mexico, that there was a real serious threat to the community.
Capitalists held numerous meetings to organize a deportation of striking miners. Sheriff Harry Wheeler was put in charge of gathering the men. During the preparation process, men and women were brought over from the strike in Cornwall, England, to replace the deported men in the Bisbee mining camps. Guns were handed out to deputies. A train consisting of 23 cattle cars was provided for the deportation, and the telegram office was ordered to disconnect all means of communication. Finally, on July 12, 1917, the deportation took its place in history. By 6:30 a.m., nearly 2,000 vigilantes clad with white handkerchiefs around their arms were storming the streets and barging into strikers' homes. Men were dragged from their beds at gunpoint to the picket lines before they even knew what was happening. Women and children were brutally attacked if they interfered. Many deputies stole money and personal items while they raided the homes. Only two deaths occurred. However, they were the result of a personal affair between a deputy and a striker. The rounded up men were gathered at downtown plaza and later marched in two lines to Warren Ballpark by the rifle-armed, loyal Americans. The deportees were simply asked one question: "Are you working?" The men that gave in were sent home, while those who stood up for their pro-union beliefs were loaded aboard one of 23 cattle boxcars ordered by Phelps Dodge. Manure covered the floors of the cattle trains, and it was so overcrowded that the doors had to be left open. By midday, the deportation was in full progress, with 186 guards on top of the trains to escort the men on their extensive journey. After 52 hours, the men were unloaded and deserted 20 miles from Columbus, New Mexico. Bill Cleary, a Bisbee pro-labor news reporter and deportee, kept accounts that showed that although the deportation was pointed at the IWW, many deportees were not even union members.
Picked them up and hauled them down there. And one particular time, I was talking to an old boy on Murray Gulch up there at the bar one day, and we talked about that roundup. He said, "Yeah," he says, I got picked up, and he was a gambler.
Approximately 1,186 men were deported. Back in Bisbee, a vigilance committee posted an armed blockade around Bisbee to jail and exile those who disagreed with the authoritative companies. President Wilson sent the Federal Mediation Committee, created specifically to investigate labor problems throughout the country, to Bisbee. Results of their study were specific. Companies' actions were, quote, wholly illegal and without authority in law, either state or federal, end quote. After 6 months, the government of Arizona stopped both additional deportations of men and put an end to the illegal committee acting as authority in place of the government. Although the deportation had physically ended, it left a permanent footstep in the sands of history.
Unions were ousted from Bisbee and would remain absent for nearly two decades. The deportation did, however, immediately spark efforts to organize unions across the nation. With the power Phelps Dodge gained from the deportation, it was able to buy out the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company and dominate Bisbee's copper industry. The deportation lowered copper output by 50%. The new technology introduced immediately after the deportation, such as a steam shovel, helped overcome the deficiency. But as one Bisbee citizen once said, whether right, wrong, or necessary, Bisbee never forgot the management-labor conflict of 1917.
What a beautiful little piece done by students, and indeed students who Catherine Benton Cohn can tell us something about. Catherine Benton Cohn joins us now. She's a professor of history, the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, actually, it's just a total coincidence that I was in an archive at Arizona State University, which is actually in my hometown of Tempe, Arizona. And this was, gosh, a very long time ago. I think I was a graduate student. And I ran into that young pair of high school students who I think are from Mesa, Arizona, which was the neighboring town, public high school there, and were working on a National History Day project, which ended up, I think, winning Arizona's prize that year and going on to compete nationally, and it was a terrific piece. As I was re-listening to it, I think they really hit a lot of the main points.
Well, one of the points that they really didn't get into is the matter of race.
Yes.
And that was a major point for about half of the strikers. So why don't you tell us more about the strikers and what the issues were?
Absolutely. So just to review in just a sentence what they talked about, it's true that in actually June 26, 1917, the Industrial Workers of the World, or WOBLIs as they're better known, the IWW, the Radical Industrial Union led by folks like Big Bill Haywood, called a strike in the copper camp of Bisbee, Arizona. The U.S. had been in World War One for couple of months. By all accounts, that strike was peaceful, but on the morning of July 12, 1917, just as the kids said, about 2,000 armed deputies, I'm going to use that in quotation marks, led by Sheriff Harry Wheeler, a very popular, democratically elected sheriff, Democrat, rounded up about 1,200 men and shipped them into the middle of the New Mexico desert, where they were rescued by an army camp that had been set up the year before because of Pancho Villa's raid. So this event is very well known in labor history circles, and it's been treated a lot of different ways over the years. But in more recent years, historians have noticed, and of course myself among them, but I'm not the only one, that this group, 90% of them were immigrants. And we might expect, if we were to telescope sort of today's headlines about the border backwards, we might think they were all Mexicans. But what's interesting is that about half of them were Mexicans or Mexican-Americans. I say that because many of them were U.S. citizens. But a very large number of them were from Eastern and Southern Europe. And, in fact, the men that were deported that day came from about three dozen different countries. Bisbee had a large Serbian population, for example, who large enough, maybe about 1,200 people, large enough that there's a Serbian Orthodox Church in Bisbee. There were Finns. In fact, the Finns were kind of known mining radicals. The Wobblies met at Finn Hall. But the thing that was highly racialized about this incident is that the quote-unquote deputies were overwhelmingly white or Anglo, as we'd say in Arizona, American citizens, or were English or Irish immigrants. They cleave to a very particular sense of American patriotism that caused them to make assumptions about the kind of loyalty of these strikers, when in fact many of the strikers, as I mentioned, were American citizens. Many had bought Liberty Bonds for World War One. It's true the Wobblies were officially opposed to World War One, but the big thing that I argue was sort of the one strike demand that managers absolutely could not abide was that what were called surface workers, the men who worked on the top of the mine rather than underground in the more elite skilled jobs, and we might think of those as worse jobs, but those were actually sort of better paid and more highly socially valued. But the surface workers were predominantly Mexican, and one of the demands of the strikers was that the surface workers would make $5.50 a day, and the underground workers would make $6 a day, whereas at the time they made about half what the underground workers made. So, in effect, that strike demand was to erase the racial hierarchy that existed in the mine wages and system in a town that very proudly called itself what was called a white man's camp. There were white man's camps all over the American West, so-called lumber camps or mining camps that called themselves that. And we know the fiction of race because they each defined themselves differently, what that meant. In Bisbee, white man's camp meant that Mexican men could not work in underground jobs and that no Chinese were allowed to live in town at all. It was what the historian James Lowen wrote a long book about, called a sundown town, where Asians could come in, Chinese could come in and sell, say, vegetables and fruits during the day, but they could not live in Bisbee, and Mexicans could not have underground mining jobs.
Catherine, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is just contextualizing this in the terms of the 1917 immigration law that was passed.
Right.
That I know had a great deal to do with the Asian Pacific Islander population.
Right.
But nevertheless, was a law that was the most punitive of its kind, really, that had been passed in the history of immigration laws in this country, and lasted up until the time of, what was it, the McCarran Act of all
things. In some respects, yes, that's right.
So could you tell us a little bit about that and how you think this plays out within that context of that vastly xenophobic, awful immigration law?
Sure, and I'm really happy to answer that question because my first book, Borderline Americans, on which my research for this new film, Bisbee 17, is based, is about the Arizona-Mexico border and the history of race. But I've actually just written a book called Inventing the Immigration Problem that looks at something called the Dillingham Commission, the largest study of immigrants ever conducted in U.S. history, a federal commission that wrote 41 volumes of reports from 1907 to 1911. And the data that they show in the reports is actually quite equivocal about immigrants, but the recommendations they made were very harsh. And the biggest recommendation they made, their top priority, was a literacy test. And the 1917 law created a literacy test for immigrants for the first time. And it also created what you're referring to, the Asiatic barred zone, which barred most of Asia from immigrating to the United States. It actually had a map. That map actually went around Japan, because we already had the gentleman's agreement with Japan, so they felt like they didn't need to include that in the new rules. But you're right, these rules went far beyond what earlier immigration laws had done. A couple things that are really interesting about that with respect to Bisbee in particular. First of all, and not this isn't specific to Bisbee, but it's important to note in our xenophobic moment right now, in some ways that literacy test was not as bad as it sounds. You only needed to be literate in your own language. And they did allow, for example, Yiddish. So It was hoped by the people who passed the literacy test that it would exclude large numbers of people from Southern and Eastern Europe, who many people found very undesirable. And, of course, they were the largest stream of immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th century, right, pouring into the Lower East Side and Little Italy and so on. But it turns out it didn't actually keep that many people out. But to return to its relevance in Bisbee, this is a fascinating story that a lot of people don't know about. As the law was written, it applied to Mexicans crossing the border. But as soon as that law passed, just very, very quickly before World War One, the U.S. entered World War One. Anyway, what happened is, as Southwestern employers, especially in the copper mines, which were producing war material for World War One, and agricultural employers, right, who employed large numbers of Mexican migrant workers in the Southwest, they pestered and lobbied and harangued Congress to make an exception and let Mexicans cross the border without passing a literacy test because they felt they had such a demand for workers in the wartime industries. And so the Secretary of Labor made an exception for Mexicans and let them come without passing the literacy test. So some people reported in Bisbee that there were hundreds of new Mexican workers pouring in the spring and early summer of 1917, and that that was a direct consequence of this exception that was made in law by the Secretary of Labor.
So what happened to the unionized workers who were transported out of state and left in the desert? And what happened to the town immediately after that?
So that's a really good question, and I hope your listeners will really think about what this would do to a community. At the time, Bisbee was a buzzing, thriving, busy, productive town of about 25,000. It had a streetcar system. It had beautiful schools. It had families. It had a YMCA and a YWCA. So picture that 2,000 men were armed deputies. About 1,200 men were deported. So that's already 3,300 adult men who are literally either holding a gun or at gunpoint, right, being marched out of town, right? And you got to figure, so only half the town is male. That's 12,000 people, and many of them are children. So you're talking about basically a majority of adult males are directly involved in this event, right? This is literally all hands on deck. What happened to those men is that they were abandoned on it's still the Amtrak line from Benson, Arizona, from southern Arizona to El Paso, Texas. You can still take that route. I've taken it myself. My grandparents lived in El Paso, Texas. It was a company-owned railroad at the time. It was owned by the Phelps Dodge Company. And they left them at a rail stop there. And they were taken in by an army camp, Camp Furlough, that had been erected there the year before because Pancho Villa, the famous Mexican revolutionary, had invaded, made a raid on the border town of Columbus, New Mexico. And so that camp was created because of Pancho Villa's raid. However, most of the U.S. Army was busy in Mexico chasing him down, and so there was hardly anyone at that camp. And they took basically these Chinese camp cooks and African-American Buffalo soldiers took in these 1,200 men and fed them and clothed them. Some of them stayed for 2 months. As the young student said in your intro, those folks were not ever allowed back in Bisbee. There's a wonderful local historian named Mike Anderson in Bisbee who has studied, with some data I helped provide him, what happened to the deportees, and we don't think any more than a couple dozen ever came back to Bisbee ever again. They were not allowed to come back, and a committee of kind of pro-company wives, wives of mining officials and the company doctor, gave out so-called relief, gave, you know, money and groceries and one-way tickets out of town to the hundreds of wives and children of the deportees.
Wow. And we also have, I know, two people that were killed in the roundup. And if you
That's
can
right.
tell us about them. And was there any prosecution
yes.
of any of these people that were involved in this heinous vigilante ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, so a couple of things. The two men who were killed are actually the subject of one of the short films you can find on Bisbee17.com. It is in the film, but there's more treatment of that incident in a short film that Robert Greene created on his website. It's very interesting. So those two men, one was a wobbly, or at least one was being rounded up, as it were, and one was one of the deputies, and they had an incident while the roundup was happening and opened fire on one another. And there's a very moving depiction of it and the debates around it that's worth watching on the film. In some ways, though, I think it's astonishing more people were not killed when you think about the chaos of this and how many people were armed. It's really astonishing to me that only two men died. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Well, I guess I'm not even sure anymore, but what I'm interested in is the legacy. I had actually asked, I recall now, whether or not anybody was prosecuted.
Oh, yeah. I can answer that very quickly. The prosecution question is an interesting one. There were attempts to prosecute. There was both a civil case where deportees sued the mining companies and deputies. They actually had a civil suit where they named men that they knew were, you know, gunmen and tried to get redress. And Phelps Dodge apparently worked up an offer, and I'm not checking these numbers, but they're not wildly off base, where it was something like, you know, $750 if you were married and $400 if you were single, you know, something along those lines, where they had worked out a settlement, but they had not signed the agreement. And in the meantime, there was a state kidnapping trial, and the defense for the deputies argued, he made this up basically, he said there was a law of necessity that required that they restore order in their town, what we would understand to be vigilante justice, and the men were found not guilty on state kidnapping charges. And once Phelps Dodge and the mining companies realized that they had won the criminal suit, they refused to settle in the civil suit. And so there was no legal redress ever. However, and I'll get to your legacy point in just a second, because in some ways that's what the movie is about. President Wilson was pressured, as those young kids mentioned, to create a presidential mediation commission that went and investigated a number of labor incidents across the mining West and lumber West in the fall of 1917. And they spent a lot of time in Bisbee, and one of the people on that commission was a young Felix Frankfurter. I think he was still in his 20s or early 30s, and was a Harvard Law professor and an assistant secretary of labor, and he served on that commission, and he mentions it in labor decisions that he later makes on the U.S. Supreme Court of having this incredible impact on him. So I guess you could say that was one legacy. The long-term legacy is that, as the film discusses with great emotion, that most people could never talk about it in town ever again. And as a historian, there's, for me, one of the wonderful moments in this film is a woman who's descended from a company family who says, all I ever heard was that it was a really good thing and that there would have been blood on the streets and that they cleaned it up and it was necessary. And then she pauses. She's a really bright and well-educated person with a degree in history. And she said, but of course I only ever heard the company side, because the deportees weren't around to tell their side of the story.
Catherine, in terms of still of legacy, so if one goes into Bisbee today, could these same events happen? Is this really, how easy is it to rev up the hysteria and scapegoat immigrant workers? Is Bisbee still alive and well as a lesson to reckon with?
Wow. Well, it's certainly, I feel confident saying this would never happen in Bisbee anytime soon, because Bisbee is a hippie, left-wing, funky artist colony that very much supported this airing of dirty laundry and sort of thinking it through. But with respect, because they also know that they have all kinds of descendants of miners there. And that's part of what is beautiful to me as a historian about the film, is the way that history still affects us today. Do I think this could happen in other communities? I don't think I know that any better than you do. Historians don't like to be prognosticators. I certainly think that in some ways, you know, the language around immigrants today is even worse than it was in 1917.
And I keep thinking about Joseph Arpaio, even though
right,
he wasn't
Joe Arpaio.
Elected. Of course, Sheriff Joe Arpaio,
right.
etc.
Yeah. But, I mean, Harry Wheeler was a much more complicated figure than Joe Arpaio, actually. And he's treated with respect in the film of thinking about he was a sheriff who had been elected with labor support, was very popular, but also thought of him as this, himself as this sort of Western lawman. You know, he patrolled, he was in charge of a county that had 90 miles of border with Mexico, and Mexico was having a revolution. And the mining companies were very, very powerful, you know. And that was not a great position for him to be in.
So in the last minute that we have left in the realm of Trump, what are the lessons and what can we understand and what must we be wary of, since I do wonder how much more it would take for people to literally oust, to round up, to take vigilante
right.
action, because clearly that is that's what's being revved up. So the lessons that you think we need
to take me, from one
this.
Warning that I would make as a historian, because I think you could get any sort of, you know, person on the left to talk about the warnings, but as a historian, I would say be very wary of huge generalizations about what this country has done or not done with respect to immigrants. I mean, I just finished writing a book about a moment in which we passed the national origins quotas, which were deeply racist, right, and deeply discriminatory. And I honestly think much of the rhetoric today is as bad or worse than what we heard in 1917. By the same token, we had nearly open borders at that time, right? So, you know, just be wary about anybody making huge generalizations about, you know, back then they learned English or my grandparents came legally. Those answers, those realities are much more complicated, and we should really be careful about calling on, you know, false histories to serve political agendas.
And the film that Catherine's been referencing throughout this discussion is a new film called Bisbee 17. It's great.
And the director-producer of that is Robert Greene, Bisbee 17. Catherine Bentencone, you are going to come back to talk to us much more about all of this, aren't you? And to have a discussion on your books as well.
I would love to do that, of course.
Oh, great. You're wonderful. You're vivacious. You're bright. You're energizing.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.